The Guardian.
I'm Chris. I'm a developer myself, and I've done it for so many years that I can't be bothered anymore. So I basically wanted to make sure that younger guys get the chance to do the things that I'm doing day by day and don't have to do the same mistakes that I had to do to learn it. Because that's the biggest problem. Like, every time we get a new developer in, he has to go through the three ideas and has own ideas and does things. Trying to get like a code standard through in a big corporation or getting like a methodology through is unbelievably bad. I mean, the time a lot of companies actually waste trying to get an IDE that everybody has to use or an operating system, you will never make your developers happy that way. It's much better to look at systems, how you can actually put them together later on. So today I want to talk about things that I wish I had heard about several years ago, because I've spent a lot of time debugging and doing stupid things and wondering why they don't work instead of doing things right from the start. And the benefit these days is that the internet world is a lot more mature than it used to be. When I started, I had Netscape 3 and Internet Explorer 5 and Internet Explorer 4, and the IDEs weren't clever, there were no debugging tools. It was really, really hard to find out what went wrong when you had a JavaScript error, for example, which was like things like undefined is not defined, or object is not an object. And you're like, well, why is that an object if you tell me it's not an object? But then Firefox came around and these things, and nowadays you can play a lot better and browsers are better for you as well, so we don't have to do the same mistakes again. And of course, being a developer myself, I heard a lot of them, but I was arrogant enough not to use them. And that's the biggest step that every developer that I hired and I actually encouraged and mentored as well had to understand, that it's not about you, but it's about you and the team. You don't really develop for yourself, but you develop for the guy that takes off from you. And how many times have you been thrown in a project and got some code from somebody that you didn't understand, there were no comments whatsoever, and you were like, what kind of idiot was that? Just to find out in the CVS tree that it was you 4 months ago. So I've spent a lot of time developing websites for various companies. As I said, I worked for eToys, I did visitbritain.com in a four-month project in India, and McDonald's Coded UK, the European website for HP, and all of these things. Worked a lot with enterprise-level content management systems and started loathing them and realized that six figures is not necessarily a sign of quality. And I basically wanted to go through some of the ideas that I found that work for me. And I thought I'd call it creating happy little websites. So in case you don't know that man, he's American, like Rolf Harris. He paints these pictures with this feather brush, and it's a really, really bizarre show. And I just did it because the hair is the same as Matt's. Happy websites are working websites. Actually, the website, when it doesn't work, when it doesn't go for the user what they came for, then it's not necessary. It doesn't matter how pretty it is. If it doesn't solve the problem that the person came for, then you will be out of business and they will go to somebody else that might not be as pretty but actually gets the information there. That's why things like Google works. Google is not pretty, but Google basically, I type things in and I find things in, and they don't try to be anything else. And that's great. That's a good concept. And the definition of a working website is completely out of your hands. When we say, oh, this is this big, everybody has a browser like that. This has JavaScript, but everybody has JavaScript turned on. That can never be a bet that you can win, because there will always be situations where there is an environment that you didn't think of. And sometimes it's not because people are evil and actually want to have bad browsers, but sometimes it's because their company doesn't allow them to upgrade their infrastructure. It also means that things like Vista don't sell themselves as well as they wanted to. That's why Internet Explorers don't get upgraded, and we have Internet Explorer 6 still on our hand. Because Internet Explorer people just basically upgrade when the operating system upgrades. They would never download a browser. So if the operating system doesn't come with IE7 and IE8, we will not see it. And that's a big, big problem. Every time I meet somebody from Microsoft, I shake them and say, please fix that. A bit of a problem as well. So you have no clue who uses your websites with what and in which state. When I get home drunk at night, I have a different vision than I had in the morning. When I'm in some internet cafe on holiday, I have an internet connection that's two tins and a wire. And I wonder why my site is so slow, because on my connection at home, it's awesome. So you can never actually predict what people do and what they have out there, especially in terms of abilities. I'm a big accessibility freak, and I've been a consultant for that for several years. I'm organizing an event now in London as well for accessibility hacking. And the biggest problem is that we don't get the information that we need, because nobody wants to be known to be disabled on the internet. Nobody wants to admit to themselves that they have a disability. I've got a disability. I've got glasses. I mean, I'm okay with that because in the morning I stumble around and try to find my glasses. But a lot of people on the web will not tell you that. They just like, when you say like, oh, if you're disabled, use this path, that will not work because people will not tell you. And that's a big problem because we assume all these issues that people with disabilities have and we fix for them without asking a real disabled person. And that's the best thing you can do. We have several developers now who are blind, and that's just wonderful to have next to you. And it's rather humbling to see that a guy writes PHP faster than you do, although he can't see the screen or just hears to himself coding. That would drive me nuts. I mean, I normally don't understand what I code. This is 100% fact and deal with it. There is no way around there. Whenever you say like, well, we can ship it out because everybody has 1024 resolution in that area that we're sending it to, that's a recipe for failure. I had a client that basically had, where the CTO had IE5 and wouldn't upgrade because of security reasons of all ludicrous ideas. So we had the chance, do we do the project and do we spend three more months fixing it for Internet Explorer 5 or do we find a way around? What I've done, I looked at his computer, got his IP address. Every time his computer looked at the system, we showed him screenshots. And he signed it off because that's all he tested for. And that's sometimes it just needs to help. You have to work around. And he hadn't found out for 2 years, and it was great. Project was done. So how can you deal with it? You can do things like that, or you can keep the damage as low as possible. So if there's a 5-pixel difference between Internet Explorer and Opera, who's going to be killed by that? Nobody. A lot of times we test our things as testers or as coders. We don't test it as users. If the user experience is the same in the browser across the site, that's what's really important. If it's different from browser to browser, that's not really important because you don't jump from browser to browser. The only time you jump from browser to browser is when it doesn't work in one of them. And God forbid, that should never happen. And you make it happen by not relying on anything. Like, I don't trust browsers at all. I know they steal my money when I'm out of the house. It's just basically don't rely on that it does anything, but test everything that you do before you apply the browser to it. If you put a style sheet in there, make sure that you check that it renders before you put it live. And a lot of systems, when you're from backend development point of view, there's like build systems that break the build when that's going on. In our job, in the front-end world, that never happens because there is no breaking. That said, Opera has an internal unit testing for CSS, but they don't release it live yet. It's really annoying. So I keep talking to people about it, so they poke them. Let those who care about a certain technology deal with it. And that's a big, big problem in our market right now. Everybody likes to hire people that are across the whole platform. They know their Java, they know their CSS, they know a bit of JavaScript. We're not allowed to be experts in our fields. And that's a big, big problem. I mean, I can go to a general practitioner when I feel sick, but if I need open heart surgery, I'm not necessarily going to go to the same person. There are skill sets, and especially JavaScript and CSS are skill sets that are so mixed between computing and classic programming and designing that it really needs people with dedication to do these right. And if you don't have that dedication, then you build bad products. Okay, you might get them out of the door, but you're annoyed with it. If you don't like writing CSS, you shouldn't have to do it, and nobody should force you to do it. You should find somebody who likes to do it and work with that person and build great products. Without caring for the technologies, we have to create websites, and they will be unhappy websites because they will not work properly. The CSS will be massive, the HTML will be maybe HTML, maybe something that looks like it, and the JavaScript will be auto-generated from a Java thing and basically have a performance that is through the roof, and that's just not good. And if that happens, you will lead to unhappy users, your people will not like you anymore, unhappy bosses, and you will lose your job and end up dancing half-naked for tourists in Covent Garden, which is only one outcome of it. The technologies we use are HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. And this is what comes out at the end of any development framework. It doesn't matter what you use. If you use Java, PHP, Rails, Python, Lisp, COBOL, whatever you want to do. In the end, you will have some HTML, some CSS, and maybe some JavaScript that browsers have to deal with. And if you don't have control over that, then your system is a bad system because you will not be able to fix it for the problems that are out there. And this is also what gets rendered and executed in the unknown, and that's the main problem. Like, I can never predict the browser out there. I can test maybe what the browser is, but most of the time I will make assumptions about this. There's something I will talk about later. I will have lots of links at the end of that, so basically you don't have to worry about like when it gets fast here because there's everything you can read up. HTML is your foundation and structure. Without HTML, there's nothing in your page. Like, if you generate a lot of things with JavaScript and hope people get it, well, good luck, because search engines will not find it. And you will not be found, and search engines bring you most of your content on the web. Google starts indexing JavaScript a bit as well, but only it checks if there's some URLs in there or something like that, rather than real looking for content. HTML is markup, and need to tell the user agents what it is and what to do with it. Like, most of the time, people put some HTML tag in there and some content in there, and yay, the browser renders it. And a lot of browsers are far too forgiving for their own good. That's why people never saw the quality or the idea why HTML needs to be good. And HTML needs to be good for several reasons. It needs to be good for predictable rendering, that it actually works in the browsers. It needs to be good for conversion. If later on, out of a sudden, you realize you're moving to another framework and you want to convert your HTML to something else, to a PDF, to an XML, or whatever, if your HTML is clean, it's easy to get this data out. If you have to write screen scrapers and try to find where the content is, then you have a real problem. Yahoo just released a thing called SearchMonkey, which is a plugin system for our search results page. So you can write little plugins that show search results from the Guardian site with more information than Yahoo actually knows about you. And that information comes either from your HTML structure, from microformats, or from an RSS data feed. But if your HTML is really, really clean, in like four or five minutes, you can write one of these plugins. If it's really a mess, like BBC sites at times, it's really, really hard to get that data out there, and it's not fun to do. So the first thing is a valid doc type that basically tells the browser what that is. Everybody who ever worked with XML will not take an XML from a third-party provider without an XSD or a RelaxNG or any other schema to validate against. Yet with HTML, we're completely okay with that. I wish browsers would have like a big warning sign saying like, this looks like HTML, but it really isn't, and if you have some problems with it, here's the webmaster to contact. Because we just throw things out there, and we are at the mercy of the browser industry, and that's never a clever idea. It needs a language definition, because if you're, for example, a blind person and you listen to the websites, it's not fun to listen to German text written out by an English voice or a French voice speaking German or whatever. It's like, if you have your language defined, then actually you have an opportunity to pronounce these things the right way, and search engines have a better option of indexing your content, because every language has stop words in it, like and to and is, that basically are not keywords, but you have to find out which ones they are to index the keywords. If I don't know the language, it's basically just a bet. If I know the language, I know what the stop words are, and I can test it against the whitelist. And encoding instructions, I mean, we've all saw the question marks or the little squares instead of characters, so that's not a very good idea as well. You need to follow the rules of HTML. People love HTML as their playground. Oh, I just make up custom attributes as I want to, or I don't close that, the browser works anyways, this browser works anyways, the next one that comes around might blow up in your face. Custom attribute is okay, you can do with it, but you have to explain the next developer that takes over from you what that custom attribute is. And that's an overhead, that's not really necessary, because there are ways around that. This ensures that user agents should do what you tell them. They never do completely, because browsers are evil, as I said. And it also ensures that that removes one more source of problems, and you can hand over to the next developer without having to explain what naughty things you've done to the markup. The amount of times I sit there with people like, oh, we did this batch system, and you have to use it by this and that in your HTML. And I'm like, why didn't you give me a config object? Or why didn't you just allow me to put a class on that thing, and then I have validating HTML? HTML, I cannot produce quality code if I can't validate what the quality is, what the quality criteria is. On the other hand, you have these validation zealots that basically like, oh, you have an unencoded ampersand in your page. And you're like, yeah, that was Google Ads, not me. So validation is a means to an end, not necessarily the end of validation. It's the start of a validation process, because in the end, a human has to look at it. You cannot test for semantics. Does this really make sense? It's not possible for a computer to determine. That's what we need humans for. HTML provides hooks for other technologies, which are IDs and classes and element names. You have element names and nesting structure, so that's the most important thing, actually, that you use the right element for the right job. And do not reinvent HTML, as you'd also need to reinvent the UA support. I talk about UA, and that's actually most of the time a browser, but the term is user agent, because it could be some assistive technology on top of a browser, it could be a mobile phone, it could be a text-to-speech interface, it could be anything. The internet was developed to be independent of the technology that you use to actually take it in. And that's a great thing about it. That's why I started and left radio, because I realized, like, hey, radio, there's not much I can play with. But with the internet, hey, I can show it on a rabbit nowadays, on a little plastic rabbit. It's great. Nest as much as needed and provide enough hooks, but don't nest for the sake of it. That's a big problem when you start writing your own content management systems and your own templating systems. And then you have a class and an ID on every element of there, and then you nest them 15 times. And all of a sudden, you got 20 divs with 20 indentations, and your code is not readable any longer. So make sure that you build the whole thing up front and then chunk it up into little bits, and then you actually create the HTML that you need, not the HTML that you think is necessary. Because it's not much. It's not much on file size. But when you see, for example, our figures, Yahoo Finance has 100 million page views a day. So if we have a few K shaved off of that, that's about 20 grand all in all that we could put into other things. And these are the kind of things you have to think about. And we normally don't do, but hey, if you get that problem, great, because then you have so many users. It's great.
So, Christian, can I just ask a question about that point you just made? So what is the problem with having deep nesting in the HTML?
It basically makes it unreadable. And it also makes it hard to analyze. Like if you do DOM scripting and you search for a div, you out of a sudden have 6,000 in there rather than like 20. So your loops will become a lot slower as well. So it's basically just messy. Any code that you can cut off that you don't need is a good idea. It's not about what you can add; it's about what you can remove. And if you can't remove anything anymore, then you have a great IT system. Yeah, for hooks and things like that, it's like if you write widgets, for example, reusable widgets in a framework, then sometimes you have to put classes on everything and nest an extra div in there just for safety. That's not a problem. But if your main layout is like 8 levels deep in divs, that's not really clever. IDs and classes are there to define special elements and provide hooks for other technologies. ID is unique to the document. Big problem with Internet Explorer. Internet Explorer doesn't know the difference between a name and an ID. So if you have something with a name and you do get element by ID, it will find that named element as well, which is sometimes really dangerous with like if you do like checkboxes and things like that. Good JavaScript libraries work around that for you, but we come back to that later. It's a very special case. Carries a lot of CSS weight, like the specificity. Wonderful word, of an ID is really, really high compared to others. And it's darn easy to access in JavaScript because you have document get element by ID, and it should be only in there once. If it's in there twice, your JavaScript will break. And I've seen people spend an hour trying to debug that because the HTML they couldn't touch. A class is defining a difference or grouping. So a class should be the odd one out of an element section. So if you have, for example, a navigation, you shouldn't have nav item class on each of the items. You should just use your CSS with like hash nav li, and then you're okay with that. If there's a current one, then that should get the class of current. So if you have a class on everything, then you haven't quite grasped HTML as well, because that's there to actually get the odd one out, not to define all of them. Where it helps you with grouping, if you have different elements that are scattered all over the page and not in the same parent element. That's where, for example, microformats come in. If I got vcards all over the page, then I actually have one class in there to be able to access them with JavaScript or any other converter. Use both sparingly. If you understand CSS, you don't need that many, because the coolest thing about CSS is that it cascades. And that's what a lot of people actually don't use for its own good, because the idea is that you define something for the main cause, and then you go down to the specifics. So put as much of definitions in your body and in your P elements and in your LI elements, then you only need to override them on a case-by-case basis with a background color or a different line height in different parts of your page. But your CSS becomes a lot, lot smaller that way. So you define from the common down to specific. So body P, content P about. So you go through all of these little steps, and the more you have, the more selectors you have, the less your values should be in there, because you already defined something up front. The browser does that for you, and you don't have to do it. You don't have to apply it, and that's a great thing about CSS. I love it for that. And this will keep your CSS clean and mean and easy to maintain, and it also means that maintainers know where to edit things. Most of the time, we get some CSS from somebody who's done it a year before, and then we don't have time to look through it, and we just go to the end of the document and add some more lines of CSS. We put lots of selectors in there to have high specificity, so it actually overrides it. And if that's not enough, then we put another div ID in the HTML, and then we override whatever we have. I had that with one of the systems that I built that was 26 languages, 140,000 pages. And I had the 14 templates that we used were like 300 lines of CSS that I've written. 2 years later, it was 6,715 lines of CSS with things like heading 666, blue left as selectors and these kind of things. So it's make sure that you comment your CSS as well and you explain people what the layout is, that you have your blueprints there and your wireframes and say, like, this is the ID that we gave these things, because maintainers will mess with your code. Don't make it messy from the start, but there will always be a bit of attrition during the project. The sort of thing makes websites very unhappy. And the other thing is naming conventions. I mean, as I just said, HTML heading left 666 is not a clever idea. Always explain what the thing does rather than what it looks like, because in 2 months' time, you will have a new white labeling of the website, or you have to have a change, and then your heading green becomes a heading yellow out of a sudden. And you don't rename it, you just set a different color to it. So the whole intuitive idea of calling it something that it looks like is not there anymore. And it might not look like that way in other browsers as well. Or I might be colorblind, and your heading green is a heading gray for me. Keep it short and understandable, and don't abbreviate too much. I mean, I love people that do these abbreviations with like dashes in between, and 1 week later you look at it like, what was that again? Oh, there is an extra wiki page where we explain what the abbreviations mean rather than just writing English. Yeah, English is a good idea, because if we work internationally, it's a good idea to keep it English, because English is easy to understand. I just went through some code from Korea, and Korean comments are not really helpful. CSS defines the look and feel, not the behavior. A lot of times you will find these cool CSS-only menus or CSS-only tables with sorting and all kind of things. It's a bit of mental masturbation of CSS people, because it basically is not helpful. And it is not keyboard accessible, and CSS has a binary state. CSS is basically, here, browser, do something with it. With JavaScript, I can say, browser, can you do this? Yeah, okay, then do it. Browser, do you have enough space to put that menu on the left? No, then please show it to the right. With CSS, I don't have any of those things. Simple rollovers, no problem with CSS, but when it comes to cool menus and stuff like that, not really the right technology. This is what JavaScript is there for you. And JavaScript is cool, but it's basically, if you can avoid it, if possible, it's okay. There's nothing that is missing. JavaScript is great to make your sites more intuitive, faster, save you some server loads, but JavaScript should be there for the end user. If the end user benefits from JavaScript, if they start typing and they find their solutions immediately rather than going through 5 clicks, that's a good use of JavaScript. If you use JavaScript to protect yourself from spamming, or you make sure that people cannot submit forms without JavaScript, that's not helping them, that is helping you. And actually, spammers will find a way around that. There's no security in JavaScript, because of the model JavaScript is built. That's one of the biggest problems that people like us and Google and Microsoft have to deal right now, to find a way to sandbox JavaScript and to make sure that people can't override it to do nasty things. I mean, even if you put it in an iframe, you can still write top window location and send the user to another page and actually make them enter their credit card data there. So relying on JavaScript for security is a bad, bad idea. But It's a good technology to make interfaces more intuitive and avoid steps that are unnecessary if the computer and the browser and the user can do it. That's fine. So make sure that your JavaScript works independent of input device. It should be keyboard, mouse, voice recognition, whatever people can come up with. Normally, click handlers are rather safe because they actually work with everything out there. And also make sure that you only, when you write JavaScript and generate JavaScript, you generate good HTML and not just random stuff. Because screen readers, for example, for blind users, they understand JavaScript as much as browsers do. So just turning off JavaScript for people with disability is not a solution. Actually, you have to follow the same rules that browsers have there. And play it to its strength and don't expect it to work like Java, Ruby, or Python. I mean, JavaScript is such an in-the-middle language that everybody wants to play with it. The CSS guys want to have it for CSS selectors. The Ruby guys want to have it for enumerators. Java guys just like it because it has Java in it. And it's basically a language that everybody wants to play with, but not many people understand, and that's the really funny thing about it. Happy websites come from mature development processes and methodologies, and that's something where we're just at the beginning. And I mean, someone from The Guardian was at Media and talked about this, how you do it, and we talk a lot about how we do it. And it's basically, and on the backend systems and on Java platforms, we have these wonderful methodologies to build things, and we have release processes. But with the front end, most of the time, all bets are off. So, hey, this one goes live. It's not really okay, so let's go into VI on the live server and change it. And this is how you get out of sync. This is how you make systems unmaintainable. So we have to think about how we approach this. One of the methodologies or ideas that we build everything on, and I was very adamant about, is progressive enhancement, which basically means that you build stuff that works, HTML, CGI, you send your forms off, you get your stuff back from PHP, done. Then you have some enhancements, and then you actually, every time you apply an enhancement, you ask the browser and the environment, is it really possible? Do you know about this object? Do you have as much screen space available? Is this HTML element really there before I try to modify it? It's basically a safer way of approaching things. Just test before you go. It's a bit like testing the depth of the river before you jump into it. Good idea. Accessibility is not nice to have or something to add on at the end. Build with accessibility in mind from the start and everybody will benefit. It's amazing. One of the best cases out there is Legal in General, where a workmate of mine actually worked before, and he made their sign-up forms accessible by cutting down on the IA, by making it a lot easier to understand, bigger buttons, and they tested it with disabled users, and they threw it out there and had like a third more users in the first month, just because people were not annoyed anymore by filling in their forms, because it was easy and step-by-step understandable what's going on there. And most of the time, usability and accessibility go very much hand in hand. If it's not usable accessibility, don't bother with it. To make things appear like interactive elements, use interactive elements that work across all input devices, buttons and links. And that's about it. That's all we have. There's ideas like Area, where you can turn anything into a switch and things like that. That's great, but we're not there yet. But definitely keep an eye out for that, because that's going to be really, really cool. Because Area is built to work with assistive technology and with browsers to actually turn interfaces into really accessible interfaces. Because right now we reach the limits of HTML really, really fast. Because most of the time we write applications that have things like sliders and menus and option groups that really are not supported in HTML. There is no HTML element for it, so we come up with random stuff. Whereas Aria has, for everything, it has a role and a state. So something could be a role of a slider and a state of 90. And you can change these two things, and then browsers would convert that into sliders for you automatically in the time when we have the flying cars and Internet Explorer 7 will be out. Build processes are very much important. Validation, collation, and documentation are not nice to have. They're actually, if you don't do them, you will never build a nice, a good running website. It will never be a happy website. Validation ensures that code is very likely to work. I talked about this before. Like, if you send things to a browser that might be anything, the browser will do anything with it. If you send something to a browser that says, hey, by definition, you should do this, there's a big chance that it will do. And if not, you can file a bug in Bugzilla with open source browsers, for example. More importantly, it means that the next developer can also use the code without knowing your hacks. And we're very proud of our hacks, but we never explain them to anybody. And that's not a clever idea. If you make a distinct differentiation between development code and deployment code, you will build much happier websites. And that's a very important thing to consider, because in our case, for example, if you have websites that have so many users, they have to be so good in performance that they're completely unreadable to a human person. And we have to rename things, and it just doesn't make sense to have this code for humans, because it would mean overhead and you would have a headache looking at that code after a day. So development code is for humans. It should be readable, documented, well-structured, and follow defined code standards. If you haven't defined these code standards, have fun. Deployment code is for machines. It should be collated, minified, like no white space when it's not necessary, without comments. That's a big, big no-no to have comments on live code. I found systems that I could actually hack by having HTML comments in there explaining me what server they're connecting to. Best example was Live.com, the new Microsoft thing. They renamed Hotmail, and you could get Live.com mails. But basically, they said, in 2 months' time, you can start signing up for that. I got Chris@Live.com because all I did is rename the drop-down menu that they've done in Firebug and send it off. So, and actually, there was a comment in there, like, with an extra commented out option, Live.com. That's how I found out that the system is already live, but they haven't pushed it yet. So don't put any HTML comments in there. It's a very, very dangerous thing to do. And it could be optimized for the environment. That's what things like Google Web Toolkit do, or also Opera Mini. Opera Mini is a clever idea because it's a proxy system that converts your code into something that is digestible for that different mobile phones. And if we thought browsers were terrible, mobile phones are a whole different world of pain, because all of them are different. Happy websites have separated from the back-end business logic. That should be a common thing nowadays, but actually with new frameworks like Python and Ruby on Rails, people tend to start mixing them again. All of them are defined from the start not to mix the presentation logic with your model and your controller, but a lot of people do in the second step, because then it has to be done quickly, and I want to do it in 5 lines of code rather than 20 lines of code, because then I'm awesome. And it doesn't work out, because it will mean unhappy front-end code, because most of the time the back-end coders don't really want to know about HTML and CSS, because it is a boring thing to do. And there's a high possibility for security holes, because most of the front-end coders are not necessarily the cleverest people when it comes to filtering out content from the user. I mean, if you look around what PHP systems are out there that have XSS vulnerabilities from the start, it's unbelievable at times. My favorite was at the Coding Horrors, where this guy did a... he basically allowed an exec via an HTML form. So he would just pipe anything through you put in his HTML page to his server to execute on the command line. Great idea. If you can, build with APIs internally, because this allows for parallel development, and you can release them for the outside world in the future. It also means that you're very, very scalable. If you build your API and you get your API to the front-end guys that build the interfaces with them and they just get the data, then they can build whatever they want and the back-end can be whatever it wants to be, and you can easily shift it out. If you talk from the back-end to the front-end all the time, it's a big, big problem. Flickr, for example, had internally all the APIs that we have outside now. Then they put it live, then out of a sudden they realized that people scrape the page like hell and just download all kind of photos, and they're like, okay, so people want the programmatic access to Flickr. Here is our APIs. Done. Second most successful API out there, just because they already built with it and made them to scale. Happy websites are well-performing websites. That's a big subject at the moment. Just last week, there was the Velocity Conference in San Francisco, which was all about web performance, and there were some really, really good slides out there. On the O'Reilly site, you will find all the slides for download at the moment. It's not a small subject. But there are some easy rules. I mean, like, if you want to delve into it, you should have a specialist for performance. It definitely should have somebody if you have a big website. Same, you should have SEO consultants, which I guess you have. There are some easy rules. There's CSS goes in the head, and as few CSS style sheets as possible. The benefit is that basically the browser loads it up front, it already renders the right way, and it will be there, and it's not much overhead. JavaScript, on the other hand, is possibly the best way to collate it into a single include and put it at the end of the document. Because the problem is every time Internet Explorer, or some other browsers as well, come to a script node, they basically stop rendering. They don't do anything with the HTML anymore until they found out what has to be executed in there or loaded the other file and actually executed that. So the more script nodes you have in your page, the slower it will render. And that's a big problem with advertising as well, because some of them have script nodes that create script nodes that create another script node, and you get a coffee before your page renders. Cut down on the amount of images you use. Every HTTP request slows down your page, because it's not only an HTTP request, it's also a DNS lookup, and it's loading the image. So all of these things have your connection to your server already there. There's multi-threading, but it's still very, very slow. And browsers download 2 things at a time, never more. So if you have 50 images up front, they will start loading, and then you paint the rest of your page. A great technology is CSS sprites. CSS sprites basically means you don't have single images for everything, but you have one big image, and you just use background position in CSS to shift that around. And it's a great, great way of having all the little icons on your page in a second on the page, and then just they show up everywhere. And you don't have that effect that pop, 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 and your layout starts spreading around. It's a great, great tool. Avoid interaction with DOM in JavaScript until it's absolutely necessary. Every time you read and write to the HTML, it's a slow, slow process, and it's also an insecure process, as I've showed with that life.com hack. Like, you cannot trust your HTML. If you write an application, have your application data in object representation and only render it out to the HTML for viewing. Don't ever use HTML as your data source. Not a clever idea. Especially you have loads of problems with UTF-8 encoding, reading and writing to the DOM. For example, instead of looping over a document and changing a lot of settings for every element matched to your criteria, just add a class to the parent element in CSS and let CSS do the rendering for you. That's the fastest way of doing anything in a browser, and it's amazing how many times you write loops that you can actually replace with that. The other good thing about it is that you don't have to worry about the look and feel. So if you don't know anything about design, tell your designer, here, I've got a dynamic class for you that gets applied to that when something happens, so you can design it differently for that. Classic case is put a JS class on the body when JavaScript is enabled. So if you have something that is like a list of elements, for example, that turns into a carousel, if you put a JS on the body, this will actually render immediately and don't give you that stupid like flash of content problem. When it comes to event handling, use event delegation. Don't apply a handler to each element. There's a link on that explaining that in more in detail. In a nutshell, everything that you do in a browser that you click it happens on that element and happens to all the elements above it. So when you have like 50 links in a navigation, don't do event handling on each of the links. Do the event handling on the main navigation object and then read which one was clicked with the event target. And that's an amazing way of actually making your applications a lot faster and use up a lot less memory. Make the site available as fast as possible, then get the nice to have. So the initial rendering time, like when does the interface look like I can play with it? That's the most important thing. You cannot measure that with computers. You have to measure that with people. Because like, do you really think it's okay now? And that's the biggest problem when you play with things like Comet, that you have the constant loading thing going on. And some people will sit there for 5 minutes in user testing and not start touching the page because they think it explodes if they click something. Lazy loading of scripts and images has a massive impact on perceived availability of the website. Lazy loading means that you load scripts when and if they are needed by generating script nodes using the DOM. So when your page loads up front, you just put up loads of objects that are object structure. And if you need different libraries or validation code, these kind of things, you basically load them after the page has been rendered. You say like, hey, is there a form in the page? And if there is a form in the page, load my validation code. Before that, you don't need it. Nobody needs to load a lot of stuff that they don't need. And if JavaScript is disabled, they shouldn't have that anyways. Lazy loading of images means that you load a placeholder image up front, like a gray one, and only load the images when they come into the viewport of the browser. There's shine.yahoo.com uses that, for example, and we cut down our traffic by a third. And that's a lot of money just by doing that, because you don't want to load all the images when people don't really need them, and you can read out what the current viewport of the page is. Final and most important tip is that you build on what others have done well. We're learning right now. We have amazing amount of content out there that I wished I had back in the days when I started. And still, we reinvent the wheel every time we do something different. BBC just released their own JavaScript library because other JavaScript libraries did not support Safari 1.03. That was the main reason. I'm like, by the time you release that to the world in November, Safari 1.03 might be history. There's no way to run after browsers. Like, browsers are, yeah, they're liars, for starters. And just make sure that you support them as they come. And we do the graded browser support, which I'm going to go in a bit further later. That's the Yahoo user interface library. It's such a coincidence that I'm going to talk about this, which is a massive, massive beast. And people always think, like, yeah, it's a JavaScript library, same as jQuery, Dojo, I can replace them. Yeah, they are. They all do the same thing. All JavaScript libraries are out there to make our life easier as developers. That's what they're for. And most JavaScript library developers will tell you, if browsers are good enough, I'm happy to take out my library. But they're not yet. That's what they do. They make our development less random. And that's the most important thing about JavaScript libraries. But what YUI is, it's a CSS framework as well. So it has predictable layouts and typography. If you don't want to use anything of the YUI, but two things that you should use is CSS Reset and CSS Fonts. CSS Reset actually makes the browsers all the same, because every browser has an inbuilt style sheet that messes with your CSS, because headings have a certain size and color and location, divs do something different, forms have different white space around them. And what the CSS Reset thing does is actually take out all of that, and then you have a blank canvas to start from and to start styling. The other thing we have is fonts.css, which actually sets your font settings that in every browser that we support, it will be 13 pixels Arial. And then we have a percentage table that tells you which percentage to use for what pixel size. So if your designers design in pixel sizes, but you have to put percentages in to make the font resizable in Internet Explorer 6, that's a way around that. These two things, please, please just put them in. They're open source. Nobody stops you from doing that. Google are using them on their home pages, on their iGoogle pages. And it's a wonderful idea to start from scratch because you don't want to deal with all these browser issues that every browser is different and test that and spend 3 weeks testing that. We have the CSS grids, which is another 4K CSS include that allows you to make multi-column layouts and grid layouts, and they work across all the browsers that we support as well. We have the JavaScript framework, which makes all browsers work the same, and it comes with everything that every other comes as well. It comes with Ajax, comes with animation, comes with event handlers, DOM nodes. And a really nice thing about the YUI, and I'm going to give a talk about that at the Ajax Experience in Boston, is that it actually reports everything to you. So everything that happens inside the YUI that it does, you can log and you can find out. So if you start an animation, it knows when the animation started, it knows when the animation ended, and it knows the frame rate of the animation while it's animating. So you can put a throttle in there and say, like, if the animation is less than 15 frames per second and it looks really wonky, don't animate anymore, just go to the end of the animation. So people don't have to get stuck with half-overlapping menus and things like that. So there is a whole aspect of control in the YUI that I love totally. As the graded browser support, which basically is the browsers that we support. And we do this with a PHP include, which is going to be open source as well. And it's basically just some regular expression, so you can port that to Java if you wanted to. And that one actually means it tests if the browser is known to us. And if the browser is known to us, we give it CSS and JavaScript. If it's not known to us, we don't give it anything because we don't know if it will choke on it. And that's a really, really clever way of dealing with the problem of older browsers. And we look at our stats, and on these stats, we basically say which browsers can be ditched over time. Then we have developer tools. There's a logger, there's a profiler, and there's a JavaScript testing framework. So if you want to write test-driven JavaScript, you can with the YUI as well. The logger is great to make Internet Explorer also a good browser for debugging, because what's built in there is really not that good. There's the free free Visual Studio that actually is not bad for debugging Internet Explorer as well. But if you use the YUI logger, it doesn't matter which browser you use. You can log to that thing. There's validation and deployment tools. There's JSLint, which is by Douglas Crockford, which is a great, great tool to validate your JavaScript. It will hurt your feelings. It is very, very adamant about it. But what I've done, for example, I use TextMate and I have it as a bundle. So when I save a JavaScript, it will give me a pop-up and say when there's JSLint errors, and most of them are easy to fix while you're actually writing. And that's really, really easy to write clever JavaScript that way. The YUI packer is actually packs your CSS and JavaScript into a single file. And it does it cleverly, well, two files, of course. And it does it really cleverly because it runs the pack code through Rhino as well on the command line. So it makes sure that your JavaScript that you packed will still work rather than other packers that just hope that it works. It's modularized with a lazy module and image loading module option. So there's like DOM, there's event, there's all kinds of things. And you can say YUI get, I want to use the widgets, I want to use the calendar, I want to use the menu. And it will automatically generate script notes, lazy loading for you, getting them from Akamai or YCS, which is our distributed network all over the world. Which also means that if somebody has been on a Yahoo page before, they will already have it in their cache, which is another nice thing to have. It's open source. Well, open source to a degree. We don't have an SVN tree that you can actually send code in. But you can download it and fork it and use it to whatever you want internally. It's not a problem at all. We're thinking about open sourcing it completely, but the moderation overhead is absolutely mental in this kind of systems because, how many people would love to mess around with Yahoo's computer code? That's the biggest problem. My favorite story from Ajax World New York, there was this guy coming up to me. We need an API, but it needs to be really secure. And I'm like, okay, why does your API need to be really secure? What do you do? Oh, we do the tracking and the navigation software for geostationary satellites. So it's a good idea to make that safe because I would be the kind of place Pong with two of those if I get access to it. There's a massive community in documentation, so there's a Java doc style for people who don't like documentation, and there is a human-readable documentation with step-by-step examples as well for those who are like me. When I buy something, a mobile phone, I actually go with it, take the manual, throw it away, start playing with it, and if it doesn't work, I go back to the shop and complain. That's what a lot of people do. So if you write documentation for your stuff, work for that case. And if you do copy and paste examples, make sure they are really, really good. Because 90% of the people will take the copy and paste examples and mess around with them and never read what else you've written. But yeah, the YUI has great documentation about this. So these are some of the resources that I was talking about. Steve Saunders is like the, he's basically the performance god that now works for Google as well. And he organized the Velocity conference. CSSFrights.com is a tool that a friend of mine, an ex-work colleague of mine, Ed Elliott, has written. And that one is actually an online tool that automatically creates these sprites for you. You can upload a zip of pictures and it will create the slides and the image and the CSS for you, so you don't have to worry about that. And that's also released open source, and it's written in Python, I think, by now, and in PHP as well. You can use it on command line if you wanted to. This short stuff is mine. And there's more JavaScript resources as well. And that's about everything from me. So I thank you very much, and let's have the questions.
Thanks, Christian. That was great. So,
I have a question.
I also got a book for you because nobody buys them anymore. So,
so the problem we had with we were using some JavaScript libraries, especially Prototype, and the problem we had is that we only used a fraction of its functionality.
Yeah.
And although it was cached, the browsers took still quite long to parse it.
Okay. So the question was, you used a big library like Prototype, and you loaded the whole thing in. It took a lot of time to parse things, although you only needed a little bit of it. That's why most clever libraries are modularized, and you only use the things that you really need. That's a bit of like this whole comparison, like, gzipped and minified, my library is smaller than your library. That's like the old comparison thing between men, just the other way around. And it doesn't work that way because it will unpack in memory and it will have a massive memory footprint if you don't do it right. So I can't fix a Prototype for you, but Dojo, for example, does the same approach. They modularize things and only pull them in on demand. But the biggest problem that people do with JavaScript libraries is that they look at some effects or some widget that they find in a library and then just include one library after another just to have these different widgets rather than writing their own widgets in one library and actually subscribing to one library. You can mix and match them, but it's not necessarily a clever idea. And especially Prototype has also the problem that it alters JavaScript as a language itself. It overwrites the Prototype chain, and it changes a lot of little things in JavaScript itself, so it doesn't play well with other libraries, which can be really annoying. But yeah, it comes with most Java frameworks, and just put it in Scriptaculous, and you've got PowerPoint-like animations. But yeah, it's not much to do. But yeah, it's a very good point that you shouldn't just use a JavaScript library nilly-willy and hope it doesn't have an impact. It will have an impact, but the benefit of it is that you don't have to worry about all the browser differences and that it gives you access to things that you don't easier that you don't not necessarily have.
Is there a case to be made for kind of abstracting it so that you write your own functions, and so you always call your own functions, which then in turn can call a library? Do you see what I mean? So that if you ever do change that, you ever want to kind of.
So the question was to abstract instead of using the library just for everything, you write your own abstraction methods to call the library only when and if needed. Yeah, definitely. And that's basically why we have, in YUI, we have an own namespace. So everything is namespace. So it's like yahoo.util.dom. You know that's a DOM element. That's a DOM manipulation class. And we have different classes for all of our different modules. We have like yahoo.eu.sport, for example. That's also great. If you look at this code, you know exactly who's written it and when it was done. And you write your little functions that only do one thing and one thing well rather than going through the whole stack of what the library offers you. That's always a good idea. But it still doesn't work around the memory problem if you have a massive library that you just include. That's where lazy loading comes in as well. Have I bored you enough?
It's actually just when you're talking about refactoring CSS, because what tends to happen is you start talking about kind of grand plans. You think, oh, well, all of them is, we know the structure of our site, but obviously then the design's changed, and this happens, blah, 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 and then you end up with, whatever of CSS. And at what point should you be kind of looking back and seeing and assessing that and saying, well, how do we refactor this and kind of slow it down? What do you do in the halfway through when you get some design changes? Do you need time to do it?
Well, what we do with design is that designers are as much of our sprint planning in agile development as developers are. We just have like every three developer cycles, we have one design cycle. So when there's a new design coming in, then we do code reviews of what we have right now, what we can ditch off the old CSS before we create the new CSS. And this is the step that most people forget about, because we just add on and tag on to the end. But then we always make up these wonderful internal deadlines that have to be done. Like we said, we do it in a week, so we're going to finish it in a week. And like the code suffers from it then. It's not really helpful in this case. But yeah, that's one way of looking at it, that you do code reviews. And code reviews are generally, I forgot them in these slide set, I normally talk about them a lot, that basically that you do code reviews across the whole team of other people's code. Don't review your code yourself, because you will never find your bugs, of course. But other people will find your bugs. And the other benefit of code reviews and also code preliminaries is that people have skill sharing. So you don't have superstars in one department and people that just go by in the other department, but people learn from each other, from others' mistakes, and actually from other successes as well. And code preliminaries is basically when we get a design, we just put it up on the screen and we have a half-hour discussion how we would cut that up into HTML. We document that, put it on a documentation system internally. If somebody else gets the same kind of design, they can already reuse that if they wanted to. And partly what we have as design patterns on the Yahoo Developer Network as well, it came from that as well. We did interaction elements, and we then tested them with users, found out what users really need rather than what we think that they need, and made patterns out of that. So whenever you get something, review it with other people. And that's a really great thing also to keep the team happy and make people talk to each other.
Just ask to interest, how long are your sprints?
Depends on the product, but 2 to 3 weeks. Some of them are bigger, but we realize the bigger they get, the more you get into a waterfall thing again. It's like, hey, here's a sprint with a PRD document this big. Yeah. But we're agile.
You mentioned earlier about
Flutter
and how you mentioned earlier about form validation. So do you think that should always be done server-side?
Yes. Both. The question was if form validation should be done in JavaScript or server-side. I should say both. What I normally do is I write a validation control on the back end and call it with Ajax in JavaScript if necessary. So that way I keep the same validation rules in one space. I don't have the problem that I maintain a JavaScript validation and a back end validation, but I still have the benefit, like if JavaScript is turned off, I still have validation. If JavaScript is turned off, I can always use curl on the command line to spam your form to death. Not a problem at all. Curl is wonderful. Curl is the coolest tool to take your own stuff apart. You can even, I was at that MASH conference, that open source hack day thing on the weekend, and I won one of the prizes because they opened up their database, and it was a searchable HTML form to get data back rather than getting a data feed. And it was behind a login and everything, so I wanted to write an interface for that. I had no chance to reach it. So what I had to do is simulate with curl, logging in, simulate a cookie, and send that cookie back in the HTTP request to get access to the system. So I can write around the same way I could write around any login form. And it's scary when you have a blog that has a lot of hits, out of a sudden how many people are really cleverly working around your issues. There's not much safety in JavaScript. There really isn't. My favorite is when you're a little company or you're a freelancer and you have all these photographers come to you. Oh, I want to put my photos online, but what can I do so people can't save them? Keep them offline. Or I had other people that had lyrics. Lyric sites are terrible out there. They're also pop-up written and spam written and things like that. And they didn't want people to just copy and paste the lyrics from their site, so they put them in as images. And I'm like, so that's completely safe. And I wrote 5 lines of PHP in a little library that I found, did an OCR scan over that images and created text feeds out of that and sent it back to him. There's always a way around. It's like that. Obfuscation is never security, and that's the biggest problem. The other problem with security is also that we always try to make our systems very secure, but then we never pay the people enough that actually have to look after these systems. So if you have an RFID card where people would put money up there and then the help desk people get like £3 an hour, I don't think that the security has... If I wanted to hack that, I wouldn't hack it at the card level. I would hack it at the call center level.
NYTimes.com just released a Firefox plugin
yeah.
to actually do some
articles to your friends.
Mm-hmm.
So they could, I think they released it so they could do it very quickly. Do you think there's any future in targeting a browser site specifically, or is it just a dead end?
I wouldn't say, because it's an open platform. That's the really good thing about Firefox in that case. And if you write it in a very modular fashion, then you could write it for other platforms the same way. I'm quite sure this could be easily turned into an AIR application, for example. So that's the other big thing, that we have to think about browsers as rendering platforms, not necessarily as standalone software nowadays. I mean, AIR has internally the WebKit, and iPhone has WebKit internally as well. So browsers are not really desktop machines anymore. They're rendering engines. And if they allow you for doing enhancements, fair enough. It's a good boost for Mozilla, and I think that's great. But for the main market, you would have to do something like that with Internet Explorer. And Internet Explorer 8 has these slices or something like that. That is a bit like that. It's a microformatic approach to like allowing things to be reused across different sites. So that's going to be quite interesting as well when we can celebrate it in 2015 something.
A little bit of sort of crystal balling. Do you see the future of the browser? Yeah. Do you see it as being more client-side driven? Like the sort of the Ajax approach, which is, you know, a lot of stuff being rendered on client-side rather than the old CGI server-side, which is... seems to be a big trend at the moment. Do you see that?
So, the question was if I see that we're moving more to a client-side application than to a server-side application, that we push more into the client-side. Yes and no, we can, but the problem is that we don't know the client-side. I see that, and going to Ajax World and things like that, everybody has this happy, brave new world already. But the security problems that come with it as well and the privacy issues when I start storing my data on somebody's machine and he can mess around with that in any way he wanted to before sending it back to me next time he goes online is another problem there as well. And mobile phones, of course, is another issue. So when you do that, you have to go through a proxy system anyways that tests these kind of things. But that said, if you do it progressive enhancement style, there's no way why you shouldn't do it. If you install Google Gears and you recognize there's Google Gears, like, for example, Google Reader is better with Google Gears than without, but it works without as well, so that's not the problem at all. So if you can test for the things and make them then work for you, that's great, but you shouldn't make it as your main source of truth, because this future will not be there for a while. I mean, if you look at the sales in hardware, I mean, desktop sales go down immensely. Laptop sales went up, and mini laptops as well. But I can say, if we are in the crystal balling, which we're here right now, I would say that we're going to be a lot more on the internet on game consoles and TV set-top boxes in the future. Because basically nobody wants to have a computer if they don't need to. If it's just surfing, watching movies, my pictures and my music, that can be done with any Wii these days.
So that's a very good point, that every sort of device now is going to be rendering some sort of content. So are you suggesting then that the drive will be that any device will be able to render, and more than render, but actually run content, execute content like JavaScript does? Or do you see it that the server will still be the
server will be the source of truth for content,
yeah.
But there will be ways there are ways already to use client-side for manipulation, but that's once again a format issue. XML conversion in JavaScript on the client is just a pain and an overhead that nobody needs. Firefox and those do it natively, fair enough, but other browsers might not. So if you write your APIs and you expect that to happen, and it will happen to some degree, make sure that your APIs have output formats that are ready for these thin clients, which are JSON and PackJSON and like whatever our little binary formats are there. I mean, Swift, Swix, for example, which is done by Aral Balkan, which is a Flash format. He did he basically reverse engineered the binary format of Swift, and created a little converter that converts something to native Flash code. So you don't have to do any conversion of XML inside your Flash anymore, and your systems will be really, really small. So for mobile phone applications, that's a really good format. So we have to think about the formats as well as the data that we display. But I don't trust computers, period.
Yeah, I would like to know your views on CSS hacking. Do you think it's a good idea?
It was a good idea when browsers were still, and there were always clever hacks, but hacks that are basically unreadable or expect you to know everything of position is everything and the list apart, not a clever idea because it's just overhead that you do, and you will have to find them again. CSS of YUI has several hacks in them, but we kept it down as much as possible. And yeah, the whole thing about Internet Explorer and conditional comments is a wonderful idea. You basically say, you know for a fact that will only be executed by Internet Explorer 6, 5, 7 if you use that. If you use CSS hacks, you have to guess. And every time there's a new browser out, the old hacks will fail, and it's not very much of a clever idea. What is great is CSS media queries for CSS 3 and that Opera supports already. And that's just a really cool thing because you can say, like, if the browser, if the viewer, if the application has only so much, then show this. So you can read out the width of the screen and these kind of things in CSS. So CSS is moving in a fashion where it actually becomes less hackable because you don't need to hack it anymore. And that's a really, really good idea. What I don't understand, why Microsoft has inline conditional comments in JavaScript but not in CSS. That's what I never understood, because that would be really cool to have as well. So you don't have to do the underscore or the star hack in Internet Explorer, but just have a comment in there with a conditional comment and do it that way. Sadly enough, we don't have it yet. But every hack that you do will bite you in the bum sooner or later.
We've been writing code that uses a third party data source. Using sort of a pseudo Ajax, actually embedded iframes, which is their API. And we found that because we had to wait until all their calls were complete to render it, and because sometimes that involved lots of calls, it was a very heavily nested callback style, which very soon became hard to handle in your head.
Yeah.
Have you got any sort of hints on a programming style to handle that sort of heavily callback based?
I would use a proxy to cache that intermittently. Maybe even with a problem was there's a third party provider that has Ajax style feedback coming through nested iframes, and it's really hard to trace back where that came from. I mean, there are tools that allow you to do that. There's HTTP proxies that show you what is coming with which request, which is always a good idea. There's lots of information at the velocity slides that way. There is like little snitch, and then there is Charles as well as another one. But I would try, if I have something that convoluted, I would try to get a proxy in between that actually filters it down to something that I really, really can rely on. And the biggest problem with any Ajax request with several data sources is that you never know the order that they come back in, unless the Ajax API is written cleverly and allows you to give a timestamp or an ID. So you will always have to do a lot of testing there anyways. It sounds like I would have to look at it, but trying to separate it as much out from the main source where the error occurs to something that you can use and play with, even cache it halfway through so you don't have to worry about if it times out. That's the cleverest way of dealing with these kind of things. A wonderful tool to play with these kind of bits and bobs. I mean, I guess it's not available API for the world, but if you want to do it with different APIs, you want something with upcoming Flickr, Delicious, Twitter, and whatever, you could write 10,000 calls yourself and a lot of clever code. But there is a system called pipes.yahoo.com, which has a graphical interface that allows you to mix together several inputs and get one output in a format that you can digest. It could be RSS, it could be JSON, or it could be serialized PHP. And then we will also do the caching for you. So if one of these things goes down, your data will still be available. That's the biggest thing when you play with other people's feeds, to get yourself independent of their server, because we saw with Twitter that's not clever lately.
Great.
Thank you very much.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.